I have started the recorder and going to my Kindle. It's a little slow, but it's okay. We're on NTI, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, which is on page 365 in the Kindle. Where do you guys find it?
365 at the moment.
Okay. 365. Here we go. Finally, I remind you that it is through peace that you know me and you follow the path to remember yourself. Therefore, I ask you to practice peace more and more. That's kind of interesting. We have an awakening together satsang, the third Sunday of every month, where we invite a teacher from, like outside of awakening together to come and speak. And I invited a guy named Magdi on Sunday evening, and Magdi is supposed to be self-realized, and I didn't see anything in my conversation with him to cause me to doubt that. He seemed very clear. But one of the things he said that really stood out to me is he was basically saying, really all you need to do is be happy. Like, if you're being happy, that's what you really are to do. And to me, that's the same thing as this. I ask you to practice peace more and more, right? I mean, happiness, peace, they're different words, but I think, how can you, if you're at peace, you're happy. If you're happy, you're at peace, right? I mean, they're hand in hand. And really, that's our job, is to learn to be happy. And before we turn the recorder on, you were talking about acceptance. If you're in acceptance of everything as it is, you'll find that you're at peace, or you're happy with everything. And there's something very, very spiritually enlightened about just being happy. And it's such a simple thing. So we're here to learn to be happy, but happy without conditions. It's not happy if things go my way, happy if you say what I want you to say, happy if you do what I want you to do. It's just happy. No matter what.
Doesn't rely on something.
So that's what we're here to learn, is just to be happy. Or, as this says, at peace. So he says, I ask you to practice peace more and more.
We don't realize that being at peace is almost another word for happy, because when you're at peace, you're content.
Content.
You're whatever, So to me, it's almost like same as happy.
Yes, I agree. Content is a very nice word for it. And in fact, I did see Eckhart Tolle or read Eckhart Tolle once when he was talking about how people, expect this massive enthusiasm all the time. And he says, but nobody, not even an enlightened person, maintains a massive enthusiasm all the time. He said, massive enthusiasm comes when whatever you need to do requires massive enthusiasm. Like, if you need to do some project, you might get this massive enthusiasm that allows you to do the project. But there's not this massive enthusiasm all the time. And I think that content, happy, that's really what you, that's what you can expect. You can expect to be content, happy, at peace. That level of just a pleasant joy, right? A pleasant joy. So verses 3 to 8. The belief in sin does not come from action. The belief in sin seems manifest through action, but belief always comes from the mind. No one can experience the effects of the belief unless he first holds to the belief within his own mind. Therefore, I ask you to look in the mind in peace and trust, in order to be rid of a false belief. One thing that's interesting, especially in the Course community, is we do talk a lot about guilt, because, guilt is such a heavy emphasis in the Course. And, what most people come to realize as they read the Course, even if they didn't realize it before, is that they do feel guilty. And if you talk to anybody, that really still believes in their guilt, and you start telling them that they're innocent, they flat out deny it, because they know better. It's like, you don't know what I've done, right? And it's easy for you to sit here and tell me I'm innocent, but you don't know what I've done, right? But this is saying, your guilt doesn't come from what you do. Your sin doesn't come from action. This is saying that prior to any action that you've taken, so, you know, from the time you were born, there was already an idea in your mind that you were bad. It was there first. And you know, this belief that you were bad came first, and then what happened was you began to act it out in different ways. So whatever you did, you know, that's your deep, dark secret that you know that nobody else knows or you don't talk about it much, right? You could not have done that if the belief that you were bad wasn't there first. So, you know, we're sitting around thinking, I'm bad because I did X, 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 which I'm not about to tell you people about, right? That's what we're all thinking. But what this is saying is you couldn't have done X, X, X if the belief wasn't there. So the problem, it's not that you're guilty because you did something, it's that you did something because you already thought of yourself as bad or guilty. Right? It came from the belief. And, you know, sometimes, you know, Course people or new people to the Course, sometimes when they start hearing the idea of letting go of guilt, sometimes people don't accept that idea right away. And the reason they don't accept the idea right away is because they think we need guilt to keep people good. Like if you didn't feel guilty after you did something bad, you would just become more and more bad. You know, that it's guilt that makes you good. But you know, Ramana Maharshi always says, you know, he doesn't talk about guilt and the I am bad thought, but he says when you are self-realized, you know, he says that all good works follow that. You know, so in other words, you're going to be naturally good when you realize your truth, because that's what's natural to your truth. Anything that you've done that was bad came because of this false belief about who you were. And somehow when you believe you're the separated self, the idea I'm bad naturally comes with it. It's like inherent in that. So anything you did that you may have done, that if we all wanted to just be honest and agree, yeah, that probably wasn't the best thing. We've all done those things, right? Yeah, that probably wasn't the best thing. We can all agree on it. But the reason you did it was because of the false belief. So what needs to be healed is the false belief. And when the false belief is healed, all of your actions will be a reflection of your true self, love, and it will be perfectly natural. So we need to let go of the false belief, but if we're holding on to the guilt because of what I've done, we're actually holding on to the false belief.
So, like what you're saying, that actually applies to like morals as well. Like you wouldn't need
morals.
Morals, no, because your actions would automatically be pure. And
yes.
Without having to like think about consequences or anything.
Yes.
Like
so, would you agree we live in a moral universe, or the tendency of the universe is choiceless morality, or some sort of?
What do you mean by choiceless morality?
Well, in my universe, is the morality comes inherent in the quality of being.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to say this, but so I live in a moral universe because that's what its tendency is.
Yes.
So choiceless means that some guys are better at this than I am, but it means I'm doing the right thing spontaneously as I'm. There's no gap between what I'm doing and what I should be doing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I made a post yesterday on Facebook. It comes from earlier in NTI. I don't remember what chapters now, but NTI Acts. And basically, what it says in NTI Acts is, first of all, if the ego was the only guidance system we had, there would be utter chaos. Because we'd all just be selfish a-holes, right? Every one of us, right? And it would be total chaos if the ego was the only thing that we had. And so because ego was really, really strong in humanity, and nobody could really abide with the idea of chaos, nobody could be comfortable with chaos, laws and cultural rules and morals and ethics were created in every single society. So the purpose of laws and rules and ethics and morals and all of that is to keep the ego somewhat tame, right? But as we start to awaken to our spontaneous inner guidance, we no longer need laws and rules and morals, because inner guidance is higher and more supreme than they are. So it's like the lowest choice for your inner authority is ego. Like the lowest choice of authority is ego, and ego is just going to make your life miserable. The next better choice is actually to go ahead and be a law-abiding, rule-abiding citizen, and you're going to be a little happier if you do that. But the premier choice is to realize yourself and follow that spontaneous inner guidance that comes from yourself.
Kind of like just putting a band-aid on it. And
yeah, the law is
just a temporary like solution to guide you in the right way, but if you went for the real solution and
you wouldn't need that.
Your spiritual growth, then...
Yeah, you wouldn't need that. But you can imagine what life would be like, you know, without laws, you know, with as strong as ego still is.
Yeah.
And I think at an earlier time it would have been even worse, actually, in humanity, right?
Yeah.
I think humans as a whole are actually elevating. At one time, as a whole, it would have been even worse to not have laws. The things we would have done to each other in earlier times are just probably incredible.
Yeah, there's a lot more compassion and things than people used to think of each other as just animals.
That's right. That's right. So again, the belief in sin does not come from action. The belief in sin seems manifest through action, but belief always comes from the mind. No one can experience the effects of the belief unless he first holds to the belief within his own mind. Therefore, I ask you to look in the mind in peace and trust in order to be rid of a false belief. The belief in sin can also be called lack of peace, for it is this belief that causes the stab that interrupts your peace. Sin leads you to feel guilty or fearful and leads you to believe that there are circumstances you must control for your own safety and happiness. Sin tells you that an outcome must go your way or you will surely suffer. In this way, sin is a complete disassociation from who you are. Sin is forgetfulness, and in your forgetfulness, you feel the loss of everything that you are. So when this is talking about sin in this paragraph, it's talking about more than what we would call sinful behavior. This is talking about anything that we judge as not acceptable, right? We're really, you know, we maybe in our language wouldn't call it a sin if our husbands gambled. Well, we might call it if our husbands gambled all of our money away. Let's think of a better example. We might call that a sin, huh? I'm trying to think of something else that we might not like.
Addiction.
Yeah, we might call an addiction a sin, depending on who we are, yeah. But we might not, depending on who we are. Let's see, what's something that could happen? I don't know, I don't have a good example. Okay, we don't call it a sin that we were locked out of the Center for Inner Peace tonight because they changed the locks, right? And in fact, I don't think we even saw that as unacceptable. You know, we just handled it. But let's imagine that when I showed up and I couldn't get in, I was pissed. You know, let's imagine that, you know, I have a responsibility. I'm supposed to unlock the building. I'm supposed to let people in. I can't get in. They should have told me, blah, 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 blah. They should have thought about me. You know, I'm really deeming the entire circumstance a sin through my non-acceptance of it. So whenever you are not at peace, you are deeming something to be a sin, right? This is a sin. In fact, it seems like my mother used to say that. This is a sin, you know, like this situation is a sin. This is a sin. So what this is saying is whenever we're not at peace, what we're really looking at is our belief in sin. And a sin, again, is something that we deem should not be. And if you think about that, that's deeming whatever it is to be extremely unworthy. It's so unworthy, it should not be, right? and so this belief of something that unworthy has to be in the mind. And you can see how if you have that belief of something that unworthy is in the mind, someday it's going to turn on you, right? So if I think that, you know, it's totally unacceptable that they changed the locks and forgot about me, you know, when I had a class, it's totally unacceptable. This is a sin. This should not be. This is a completely unworthy situation. At some point, that's going to turn on me, and I'm going to experience myself as the completely unworthy situation, right? So it's really to our benefit to notice whenever we are deeming anything a sin. and to practice in whatever way that we can, shifting into acceptance of that situation. It's the only way we're going to experience peace all of the time is if we start learning to let go of the belief in sin. The belief that something is so unworthy, it shouldn't be. Right?
That seems like pretty much sums up any situation that you're out of. Not feeling
yes.
right, or not feeling peace, or not feeling joy.
Yeah, we don't think of it that drastically, but that's exactly what we're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was just something little. Yeah, that was a good example, actually, what you said, because it made me think about how you project, any little thing that somebody else did to you, you must be projecting that as a sin if it upsets you.
That's right.
You sinned because you didn't know what I expected you to say. You didn't know what.
That's right.
That's a really great.
Yes.
Way of thinking.
All right, so. Starting with verses 9 to 10. To rest yourself from the belief in sin, you must return your mind to who you are. Therefore, I urge you, stay in tune with your peace. Whenever it is interrupted, know it is interrupted by the belief in sin. Know that sin is only forgetfulness, and seek to remember who you are with your brothers. Okay, so what this is saying then is, when it's saying stay in tune with your peace, it's not really commanding you to be at peace always, because, you might not be ready to do that yet. But it's, by saying stay in tune with your peace, it's saying stay to where you're noticing your current state of mind. Notice whether you're in peace right now, and notice as soon as you move out of peace. And again, as soon as you move out of peace, that's an alarm clock, right? When you notice that you've moved out of peace, look, what is it that you're judging? What is it that you're calling a sin? And then notice even more, the real reason you're calling it a sin is because you're saying, this can affect me, right? So I'm saying, if I get upset because they changed the locks in the Center for Inner Peace and didn't tell me, and I don't have a key now and I can't get in, I'm getting all upset, I'm saying, this has the power to affect me. And it says, whenever you're saying anything is a sin, that anything has the power to affect you, you're forgetting who you are. What you need to do is shift back into remembrance of who you are. And before we turn the recorder on, we were talking here about, how helpful it is to think about what is it that's here, that's always here. Maybe it's here now while I'm feeling upset about the locks being changed, but it was here 5 minutes ago when I didn't know that yet and I was perfectly happy, right? What's here? And then notice, is that affected? Is that at all affected by the fact that the locks were changed? No, it's not. And if we can shift back into remembrance of who we are, we can actually drop the idea of sin instantly, and we can return to peace instantly. Because whenever we're believing in sin, what's really happening is that we're forgetting who we are. We're thinking we're the personality mind that has to have things a certain way. Starting with sentence 5. As you remember who you are, you remember that love is all there is. You may then rest in confidence and let the effects of sin pass through your mind in peace without acceptance, because you have remembered that sin is not possible in a world where separation is not real. So when this talks about letting the effects of sin pass through your mind in peace, what this really means is it's talking about if you lost your peace for a moment. So if I got angry for a moment because the locks were changed, and then I remember, oh, that's right, here's who I am, I'm not affected by this, there may still be a little bit of judgment, kind of a little residue, right? Because I lost it for a minute. And so it's saying when you return to yourself, go ahead and let that residue be there. You might even feel guilty. Guilt is a very common thing to feel, because a spiritual student will typically not only get angry that the locks were changed, but then judge themselves for getting angry that the locks were changed, right? So guilt is a typical residue. So maybe even as you return your mind to who you are, you realize this has no effect on you, you feel this little guilt residue. for having a 2 second episode there. And so this is saying just let whatever effects there seem to be from this momentary lapse, or hour-long lapse, or two-day lapse, or whatever it turned out to be, just let those things just pass through your mind in peace. Don't get hooked on those. Verses 11 to 12. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, because a quiet life is a godly life in which you hold within your mind that the process of life is God. In this way, you hold to the awareness of love. As you hold to this awareness, you extend it to the brothers who are it along with you. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. My life is somewhat busy. You know, it's just the way it is. It's busy. But one thing that I have learned is that I need to have a certain amount of true quiet time every day. And if I let it get so busy that I don't get that quiet time every day, everything starts turning into a sin again. The only way I can really accept whatever's coming in my day is to have the quiet time at the top of the day. In fact, I was just reminded of an orange juice commercial. Maybe you guys have seen it. The stewardess is going to her flight, and she's walking by a machine, and some in her voice or something starts telling her to have an orange juice, and she's like, what? It's like 3 in the afternoon. It goes, yeah, but you know what's going to happen on that flight? This is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And she's like, oh, no, oh, no. And he says, you better have the orange juice. She has the orange juice. Now she can be at peace all day because she has orange juice, right? It's the same thing, except orange juice doesn't do it. You know, like whatever. Stuff is going to happen today. It always does. Stuff is going to happen today. And if you don't have the quiet time up front, or at least if I don't have the quiet time up front, I'm more likely to be agitated by what happens today. If I put the quiet time, quality quiet time at the top of my day, it's amazing. You know, I can accept so many more things. And if I do start to feel a little stressed, I take a quiet break. And this time of year, I love it. I go out and I lay in my backyard, you know, on our turf, because it's nice out there. But I'll take a quiet break. And sometimes I only need like a 5-minute, 10-minute quiet break, and I'm ready to go back and face stuff. But if I don't have enough quiet time in my life, I get caught up in everything that's happening. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially now I'm taking through MPP and a meditation class. So, I mean, I used to meditate all the time, but then we moved, I retired and moved. And I had a very short meditation. It wasn't a priority, and I slipped back into total ego. And now we have the meditation class, and I do it every day. And I just, it makes such a big difference. It just quiets the mind so much, and also there's a lot more willingness during the day to go back and to do what I use the tools.
Yeah, to do whatever you have to do in the moment, right?
Exactly, exactly. The willingness is there. The mind is more quiet. I'm just more peaceful. And I just know a little bit more who I am.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, it's not as much meditation. It's contemplation. Although I did the meditation course she's in. I wrote it and practiced it. But as soon as the meditation course ended for me, I went back to contemplation.
Yes. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. You have to find what your thing, works, what your quiet time is.
Yeah.
It's the quiet time.
It's the quiet time.
It's
the going with the source within.
For some people, it might be a walk every morning alone, you know. Playing a musical instrument alone.
A creative outlet,
yeah. But that quiet time is very important, and if you don't take that quiet time to center, you're more likely going to have upsets during the day. So make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, right? I love the word that it says ambition. You know, when we're ambitious about something, how much attention and effort we put into making sure we have it. So if it's my ambition to lead a quiet life, I'm going to make sure I have that 2 hours. 2 hours is what I like as my minimum. Typically, I don't have anything scheduled before 8:30 in the morning. Maybe it's an hour and a half. I get up at 5:30, but the first half hour, I don't know if you can count, I'm getting coffee, feeding the dog, you know, waking up a little bit. But by 6, I'm in contemplation, and I contemplate till 7:30, and then I get up and start showering and all that so I can be ready for my 8:30 appointments. So I like to have a full hour and a half every day. I really love it. And the truth is, like, on the days when I don't have 8:30 appointments, I go longer. I can go 2 hours, 3 hours, 3.5 hours.
Yeah. That was a huge, like, game changer for me, was to realize that I used to attach so much to sleep that I would want to sleep till the very last second that I could, and then hit snooze again. And then I'd be rushing, you know, to get to work or whatever.
Right.
And then, of course, everything's going to go wrong, and I'm going to be rushing. Someone's going to cut me out, I'm going to stub my toe. And then it's just going to escalate, and I'm going to be stressed and pissed off. And, like, I would rather now have less sleep but have that time. Like, I need that time to focus. Like, whether I meditate, sometimes I just contemplate, sometimes I read.
That's right.
Whatever, but I just, drinking my coffee and having that quiet time myself to focus on my day and then not have to rush to get ready makes a huge, you know, even before I had anything like spiritual going on, it's just,
right.
Just that time really. So I can imagine like that makes me feel
yes.
Easy thinking about like how I used to do it, like 10 minutes to get to work.
You know? No wonder I was grumpy.
Yeah. Kind of
yeah, and you know, and I'm not a person to get up easily either, to be honest. So I said I get up at 5:30, which I do, but I tend to set my alarm for like 10 till 5, so I can hit snooze 4 or 5 times. So I can get up at 5:30. I like that slow wake up, you know. So I'll set my alarm for 4:50, and then I'll be up by 5:30. If, you know, I hit snooze several times. If I set my alarm for 5:30, I wouldn't get up till 6:15 or so, 6:20, yeah. So, I've learned to trick myself. All right, so verses 13 to 18. Death is the effect of sin, but sin is not real. It is only a belief in the mind that tells you that everything is as it is not. Sin is the denial of reality. If sin is the denial of reality and reality is the process of life, then death must be merely the effect of denying what is. But if death is the denial of what is, then death is the opposite of truth, which means it is untruth. Untruth is false, so death must be a mirage. Some Holy Spirit logic there. But pointing out that the perception of death does come from the belief in sin, that that's where it comes from. But since sin is not real, death is not real either. So we will perceive a death in this world, we'll perceive someone else dying, we'll see the lifeless body. But whenever you see a lifeless body, one thing you have to check is that thing in you that never changes. Does it know death right now, or is it only perceiving death? And do you know for a fact that there's a death there, right? Do you know that? You don't know that. It doesn't matter whether it's a dead dog in the road or a dead relative, right? You know something has changed, right? But do you actually know as a direct experience death? There's only one thing you know as a direct experience. What is that? What do you know directly right this second?
I'm here.
Consciousness, I'm here. Life, isness,
I
right?
Yeah.
I am. You don't know death as a direct experience. Death is a secondhand perception, right? And, you know, we take that secondhand perception and we say, oh, it's got to be true, I see it, you know? But what we don't realize is that's a secondhand perception. It is not a direct experience. And if we check for our direct experience, even while we're saying, oh yeah, I know death, I see it, we're living, we're alive. We don't actually know death. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that the ones who die have just a different type of living experience, but the living is still happening, right?
The Buddhists say that suicide doesn't really do anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
to us, it's like, wow, that's the, you know, it's the ultimate sin, or it's the ultimate.
Right.
But the Buddhists, they're not really familiar with the phenomenon of suicide. But if you ask about it, they just say, well,
what would that do?
What would blow your brains out? What would that? Because the way they look at it is, you can really, you know, that's not a solution, then you wouldn't.
Right. It's just
go really go anywhere.
Well, and at one time I was doing some coaching, and there was at one period when I was coaching, when I was working with three people. Seems to me like two were contemplating suicide and one had like a child or something that was contemplating suicide, but suicide was in three of the discussions. And to me at that point, suicide was still a pretty serious thing. And I didn't want to mess up, you know, with these people. So I went to Holy Spirit and I asked Holy Spirit, you know, what should I say about suicide? And Holy Spirit told me to tell them it doesn't change a thing. And no, I did tell them that, even though I thought, geez. I mean, I was still a little fearful, but I followed directions. I told them suicide does not change a thing, and not one of them followed through with it. Because the reason they were contemplating it is they wanted a change.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't change a thing, why do it? Right? Why do it? And in fact, Holy Spirit also told them the best thing to do is to use this lifetime to heal the mind. That's what you can do. Yeah. Okay, so sentence 7. Do not judge yourself when you feel sadness or fear over death. Always be gentle with yourself and accept your emotions in peace. But also be willing to remember that the emotions you experience are the effects of forgetfulness, and what you have forgotten is truth. As you rest yourself in quiet, seek the memory of truth. It shall be restored to you. In its restoration, all sadness and fear shall gently be replaced by peace and a quiet trust in God as all that truly is. You know, so sometimes when we're spiritual students and we learn things like death is not real, you know, that ego is so tricky. And then somebody that we care about dies, and we're sad and grieving and all that, we then also feel guilty. Like, I'm not supposed to believe in death. And here I am sad and grieving, you know, and now I'm bad because I'm sad, right? And this is saying, no, you know, don't judge yourself for that. Don't judge yourself for that. Be very, very gentle with yourself, very gentle with your emotions. But just remember, the reason I'm grieving is because I don't remember the truth. If I remembered the truth, I could not be sad, right? Because I would know that nothing has changed here. No life has been lost, right?
We need to write that down. Very difficult. The reason I am sad is because I have forgotten.
That's right. The reason I am sad is I have forgotten myself.
Or it's maybe just more like a thing. Like, even if you understand that they're still living on in a different form or whatever, if you're sad, then it's like maybe because you were... You're sad that you no longer get to
interact.
Have them in your life.
Well, yeah. In fact, I recently contemplated a Krishnamurti quote, which I thought was pretty profound. And he said that when someone dies and you're experiencing that sadness and that grieving, he said, if you really look, what you're really grieving is the loss of who you were in relation to them. You know, you're thinking about all the walks we took, all, you know, and that part of you is now gone because it was an identity you had tied up with them, and you're not really even grieving that loss of them. You're grieving the loss of who you were in relation to them.
You have to recreate a new story now.
Well, in fact, that's what he recommended. He said that's typically what people do. They have to create a new story, and he recommended that you don't, that you let that part of you die, because that's like letting part of the ego die. And in fact, you go deeper into that emptiness and just, you know, let go of everything was his recommendation. But he did say most people will fill the gap with a new story.
Because whatever and I got out of you, whatever reassurance, or you made me feel smart, or I was good at something, now I need to find another way or another person to give that to me.
Yeah, we fill the vacuum. So it's kind of interesting if you think about it, that when we're, I mean, you know, if you can say it without judgment, it's pretty selfish. You know, here we are grieving the loss of a dear one, right? A dear one. But what we're really grieving is what we are losing.
Yeah.
Right?
teacher. And I would feel really deprived if she got hit by a big Budweiser truck. I was going to be so sad. But on some level, I get that. But I'm addicted to the form that my teacher takes.
Did I tell you that I was almost hit by a Budweiser truck a couple weeks ago?
No.
Oh.
I'll make another confession. In this room, it's happened is often enough where it's not surprising anymore. But there's times when I've been thinking, and the words came out of Regina's mouth. Mm. Just at the same time, it was synchronicity or something. But it was like a thought was actually forming at the same time that you were
saying
the words. And at first it's like, what was that? Now it's like, I guess familiarity with that. But
yeah, it's kind of funny because when I was in the Air Force, we always had to train somebody else fully to do our job. And just the saying in the Air Force was, in case you're hit by a beer truck, right, somebody else has to be able to, because, the military has to continue. The government mission has to continue. So they would always say that. So when I started Awakening Together, I started telling our team the same thing. We need to have backup in case one of you guys was hit by a beer truck, because if you're hit by a beer truck, somebody else has to know all the passwords and, But what was funny is a few weeks ago, I was pulling out of the post office and a Budweiser truck was coming that I didn't see, and I almost got hit by a Budweiser truck just a few weeks ago. But I just thought that was the funniest thing, because all of my life I've been saying, if I get hit by a beer truck, somebody else needs to know this.
Yeah, actually, you talked about that in that I Am Bad.
Did I?
Yeah, you did. So when he said it, I thought, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But he even said Budweiser. He was very specific, and that's what it was. It was a Budweiser truck. Yeah, it's funny. All right, so basically this entire chapter has kind of been about the idea of sin, and the idea that sin is when we're deeming some situation or some person to be, just completely unworthy. We're not accepting. It's not even worthy enough to exist. This thing shouldn't exist. And it's teaching us that whenever we deem anything to be a sin, we're forgetting who we are. And what we need to do is shift back into realization of who we are and notice we're not really affected by this, not the observer. The personality, human, may seem affected, may be upset, but if you really look, you're going to find the awareness that is always at peace, and you're going to notice that it's never affected. And then you'll know, the situation has no effect on me, and you return to truth and you're back to peace. So this week, why don't we just try practicing that? Let's try practicing noticing when we are not in peace, and then just notice, I've judged this situation as a sin, right? And then look for the part of us that is not affected by it. Just look for it. And I'll go ahead and stop the recorder, and we can have a little bit of silence, a little bit of quiet time.
Can you say that again?
Oh, sure. I'll say that one more time. Yeah, when you pay attention this week, so when you lose your peace, then notice that you've just deemed a situation totally unacceptable. That's what you've done. That's why you've lost your peace. You've called something a sin. Then check within yourself to notice what is here that has not changed. What is here that is not affected by this? Look for that awareness in you that is the exact same now as it was 5 minutes ago before this happened. Even though my entire emotions have changed, my point of view is very upset, what is this that is me that is completely unchanged? And just try looking for it. Okay? All right.